the taking of Jericho. After the death of Moses, Joshua was appointed the leader of Israel to conduct them to the promised land. He was well qualified for this important office. He had been prime minister to Moses during the greater part of the time the Israelites had wandered in the wilderness. He had seen the wonderful works of God wrought by Moses and well understood the disposition of the people. He was one of the 12 spies who were sent out to search the promised land and one of the two who gave a faithful account of its richness and who encouraged the people to go up and possess it in the strength of the Lord. The Lord promised Joshua that he would be with him as he had been with Moses, and he would make Canaan an easy conquest to him, provided he would be faithful to observe all his commandments. Joshua had been anxious concerning the execution of his commission to lead the people into the land of Canaan, but this assurance removed his fears. He commanded the children of Israel to make ready for a 3 days' journey, and all the men of war to prepare for battle. And they commanded Joshua, saying, "All that thou command us we will do, and whithersoever thou sendest us we will go. According as we hearkened unto Moses in all things, so will we hearken unto thee. Only the Lord thy God be with thee as he was with Moses. Whosoever he be that doth rebel against thy commandment, and will not hearken unto all thy words, in all that thou commandest him, he shall be put to death. Only be strong and of a good courage. God willed that the passage of the Israelites over Jordan should be miraculous. Joshua commanded the people to sanctify themselves, for upon the morrow the Lord would do wonders for them. At the appointed time he directed the priests to take up the ark containing the law of God and bear it before the people. And the Lord said unto Joshua, This day will I begin to magnify thee in the sight of all Israel, that they may know that as I was with Moses, so I will be with thee. The priests obeyed the commands of their leader and went before the people, carrying the Ark of the Covenant. The Hebrew host took up the line of march and followed this symbol of the divine presence. The wide column filed down the bank of Jordan, and as the feet of the priests were dipped in the brim of the river, the water was cut off from above, and the column below rolled on, leaving the bed of the stream dry. The priests passed on, bearing the Ark of God, and Israel followed in the rear. Halfway over Jordan, the priests were commanded to stand still in the channel of the river till all the Hebrew host had crossed over. This was to impress upon their minds more forcibly the fact that the power which stayed the waters of Jordan was the same that enabled their fathers to cross the Red Sea 40 years before. Many who passed through the Red Sea when they were children now by the same miracle crossed over Jordan, men of war equipped for battle. After the host of Israel had all passed over, Joshua commanded the priests to come up out of the river. When they, bearing the Ark of the Covenant, stood safe upon the farther shore, God removed his mighty hand, and the accumulated waters rushed on, a mighty cataract, in the natural channel of the stream. Jordan rolled on, a resistless flood, overflowing all its banks. But before the priests had come up out of the river, that this wonderful miracle might never be forgotten, the Lord bade Joshua select men of note from each tribe to take up stones from the spot in the riverbed where the priests had stood and bear them upon their shoulders to Gilgal and there erect a monument in remembrance of the fact that God had caused Israel to pass over upon Jordan upon dry land. This would be a continual reminder of the miracle that the Lord had wrought for them. As years passed on, their children would inquire concerning the monument, and again they would recount to them this wonderful history, till it would be indelibly impressed upon their minds to the latest generation. When all the kings of the Amorites and the kings of the Canaanites heard that the Lord had stayed the waters of Jordan before the children of Israel, their hearts melted with fear. The Israelites had slain two of the kings of Moab, and their miraculous passage over the swollen and impetuous Jordan filled the people with great terror. Joshua then circumcised all the people that had been born in the wilderness. After this ceremony, they kept the Passover in the plains of Jericho. And the Lord said unto Joshua, This day have I rolled away the reproach of Egypt from off you. Heathen nations had reproached the Lord and his people because the Hebrews had failed to possess the land of Canaan, which they expected to inherit soon after leaving Egypt. Their enemies had triumphed because Israel had wandered so long in the wilderness. and they proudly lifted themselves up against God, declaring that He was not able to lead them into the land of Canaan. The Lord had now signally manifested His power and favor by leading His people over Jordan on dry land, and their enemies could no longer reproach them. The manna, which had continued up to this time, now ceased. For as the Israelites were about to possess Canaan and eat of the fruits of that goodly land, there was no more need of it. As Joshua withdrew from the armies of Israel to meditate and pray for God's special presence to attend him, he saw a man of lofty stature, clad in warlike garments, with a drawn sword in his hand. Joshua did not recognize him as one of the warriors of Israel, and yet he had no appearance of being an enemy. In his zeal he accosted him, saying, "Art thou for us or for our adversaries?" And he said, "Nay, but as captain of the host of the Lord am I now come." Joshua fell on his face to the earth and did worship, and said unto him, "What saith my Lord unto his servant?" And the captain of the Lord's host said unto Joshua, "Loose thy shoe from off thy foot, for the place whereon thou standest is holy." And Joshua did so. The glory of God hallowed the sanctuary, and for this reason the priests never entered the place sanctified by God's presence with shoes upon their feet. Particles of dust might cleave to them, which would desecrate the holy place. Therefore the priests were required to leave their shoes in the outer court before entering the sanctuary. In the court, beside the door of the tabernacle, stood a brazen laver, wherein the priests washed their hands and their feet before entering the tabernacle, that all impurities might be removed. All who officiated in the sanctuary were required of God to make special preparation before entering the place where His glory was revealed. It was the Son of God who stood as an armed warrior before the leader of Israel. It was the one who had conducted the Hebrews through the wilderness, enshrouded in a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night, in order to impress the mind of Joshua that he was no less than Christ, the Exalted One. He said, "Loose thy shoe from off thy foot." He then instructed Joshua what course to pursue in order to take Jericho. All the men of war should be commanded to compass the city once each day for 6 days, and on the seventh day they should march around Jericho 7 times. Accordingly, Joshua gave orders to the priests and the people as the Lord directed him. He marshaled the hosts of Israel in perfect order. First was a select body of armed men clad in their warlike dress, not now to exercise their skill in arms, but only to believe and obey the directions given them. Next followed 7 priests with trumpets. Then came the Ark of God, glittering with gold, a halo of glory hovering over it, borne by priests in the rich and peculiar dress denoting their sacred office. The vast army of Israel followed in perfect order, each tribe under its respective standard. Thus they compassed the city with the Ark of God. No sound was heard but the tread of that mighty host and the solemn voices of the trumpets, echoing among the hills and resounding through the streets of Jericho. With wonder and alarm, the watchmen of the doomed city marked every move and reported to those in authority. They could not imagine what all this display meant. Jericho had defied the armies of Israel and the God of heaven, but when they beheld that mighty host marching around their city once each day in all the pomp and majesty of war, with the added grandeur of the sacred ark and the attendant priests, the impressive mystery of the scene struck terror to the hearts of princes and people. Then again they would inspect their strong defenses, feeling certain that they could successfully resist the most powerful attack. Many ridiculed the idea that any harm could come to them through these singular demonstrations on the part of their enemies, but others were awed as they beheld the majesty and splendor of the procession that each day wound grandly about the city. They remembered that 40 years before the Red Sea had parted before this people, and that passage had just been opened for them through the river Jordan. They knew not what further wonders God might work for them, but they kept their gates carefully closed and guarded them with mighty warriors. For 6 days the host of Israel performed their circuit around the city. The 7th day came, and with the first dawn of light Joshua marshaled the armies of the Lord. Now they were directed to march 7 times around Jericho, and at a mighty note of the trumpets to shout with a loud voice, for God had given them the city. The imposing army marched solemnly around the devoted walls, the resplendent ark of God lighting the early dusk of morning, and the priests with their glittering breastplates and jeweled badges, and the warriors with their flashing armor presented a magnificent pageant. They were silent as the dead, save the measured tread of many feet and the occasional blare of the trumpet cutting the blank stillness of the early morning. The massive walls of solid stone frowned darkly down, defying the siege of men. Suddenly the vast army halts. The trumpets break forth into a blast that shakes the very earth. The united voices of all Israel rend the air with a mighty shout. The walls of solid stone with their massive towers and battlements totter and heave from their foundations, and with a crash like a thousand thunders fall in shapeless ruin to the earth. The inhabitants and the army of the enemy, paralyzed with fear and amazement, offer no resistance, and Israel marches in and takes captive the mighty city of Jericho. How easily the armies of heaven brought down the walls that seemed so formidable to the spies who brought the false report. The word of God was the only weapon used. The mighty one of Israel had said, "I have given Jericho into thine hand." If a single warrior had brought his strength to bear against the walls, the glory of God would have been lessened and his will frustrated. But the work was left to the Almighty, and had the foundation of the battlements been laid in the center of the earth and their summits reached the arch of heaven, the result would have been the same. When the captain of the Lord's host led his legions of angels to the attack, long had God designed to give the city of Jericho to his favored people and magnify his name among the nations of the earth. 40 years before, when he had led Israel out of bondage, he had proposed to give them the land of Canaan. But by their wicked murmurings and jealousy, they had provoked his wrath, and he had caused them to wander for 40 years in the wilderness until those who had insulted him with their unbelief were no more. In the capture of Jericho, God declared to the Hebrews that their fathers might have possessed the city 40 years before had they entrusted in him as did their children. The history of ancient Israel is written for our benefit, Paul says. But with many of them God was not well pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. Now these things were our examples, to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. Now all these things happen unto them for end samples, and they are written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world are come. Wherefore let him that thinketh he standeth take heed lest he fall. Many who, like ancient Israel, profess to keep God's commandments have hearts of unbelief, while outwardly observing the statutes of God. Although favored with great light and precious privileges, they will nevertheless lose the heavenly Canaan, even as the rebellious Israelites failed to enter the earthly Canaan that God had promised to them as the reward of their obedience. As a people, we lack faith. In these days, few would follow the directions given through God's chosen servant as obediently as did the armies of Israel at the taking of Jericho. The captain of the Lord's host did not reveal himself to all the congregation. He communicated only with Joshua, who related the story of his interview to the Hebrews. It rested with them to believe or to doubt the words of Joshua, to follow the commands given by him in the name of the captain of the Lord's host, or to rebel against his directions and deny his authority. They could not see the host of angels marshaled by the Son of God who led their van. They might have reasoned, "What unmeaning movements are these, and how ridiculous the performance of daily marching round the walls of the city, blowing trumpets of ram's horns. Meanwhile, this can have no effect upon those strong and towering fortifications." But the very plan of continuing this ceremony through so long a time prior to the final overthrow of the walls afforded opportunity for the increase of faith among the Israelites. They were to become thoroughly impressed with the idea that their strength was not in the wisdom of man nor in his might, but only in the God of their salvation. They were thus to become accustomed to putting themselves out of the question and relying wholly upon their divine leader. Would those who today profess to be God's people conduct themselves thus under similar circumstances? Doubtless many would wish to follow out their own plans and would suggest other ways and means of accomplishing the desired end. They would be loath to submit to so simple an arrangement, and one that reflected upon themselves no glory save the merit of obedience. They would also question the possibility of a mighty city being conquered in that manner. But the law of duty is supreme. It should hold sway over human reason. Faith is the living power that presses through every barrier, overrides all obstacles, and plants its banner in the heart of the enemy's camp. God will do marvelous things for those who trust in Him. It is because His professed people trust so much to their own wisdom and do not give the Lord an opportunity to reveal His power in their behalf that they have no more strength. He will help His believing people in every emergency. They will place their entire confidence in Him and implicitly obey Him. There are deep mysteries in the Word of God. There are unexplainable mysteries in His providence. There are mysteries in the plan of salvation that man cannot fathom. But the finite mind, strong in its desire to satisfy its curiosity and solve the problems of infinity, neglects to follow the plain course indicated by the revealed will of God and pries into the secrets hidden since the foundation of the world. Man builds his theories, loses the simplicity of true faith, becomes too self-important to believe the declarations of the Lord, and hedges himself with his own conceits. Many who profess our faith are in this position. They are weak and powerless because they trust in their own strength. God works mightily for a faithful people who obey His word without questioning or doubt. The majesty of heaven with His army of angels leveled the walls of Jericho without human aid. The armed warriors of Israel had no cause to glory in their achievements. All was done through the power of God. Let the people give up self and the desire to work after their own plans. Let them humbly submit to the divine will, and God will revive their strength and bring freedom and victory to His children.